Future presentation.
Welcome back to another Untitled Movie Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Matt Rohrbeck, alongside, he's allergic to tomatoes, but he is tomato meter approved, Eric Marchin.
Oh, my back. It's killing me.
Eric,
after watching The Fall Guy.
You're looking like my stunt double today.
I know. Well, that's the whole point. You know, I'm subbing in for you, or you're subbing in for me. Who is the star and who is the titular Fall Guy?
If you're an audio listener, Eric and I are wearing dark glasses, a backwards, mine's navy, kind of, yours is black, I think,
yeah.
Right? But we look pretty similar right now. Eric's copied my look for the last couple weeks. I'm not too happy about it, but I will allow it. Today we are reviewing David Leitch's The Fall Guy, starring Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and more. We're going to go full spoilers on this, I think. The movie's out now. We didn't go to a press screening or anything. So,
well, I did.
I did not. but
this movie has broken your brain.
But I think because the movie's out now and this review's
there's not a lot to spoil. Though,
I know, but
honest.
I just want to preface that in case people haven't seen it. Go see it and come back, or you could just listen to this because you're not gonna miss much.
We're in the minority, I think, on this.
We
one.
Really are, and I want to just like I never like to review a film based on other people's reviews. It's just our opinion because
it's all subjective.
It is all subjective, and that's not what we're doing. But this one's an interesting one because I had no idea. I haven't really paid attention to what other people were saying about it or anything. I knew my wife was excited to see it. I like Goofy Gosling. Like I'm here for it. I like the nice guys. I liked him in Barbie recently. I like when Ryan Gosling's being funny. So I was, you know, looking for it. David Leitch, hit or miss for me. Like I don't know. Like I think at best you get something like, you know, Deadpool 2 or Bullet Train. That's like slightly obnoxious, but like mildly enjoyable. I mean, personally. And then you get something like Fast and Furious, Hobbs and Shaw, which is just kind of whatever. And same with Atomic Blonde. And I know he co-directed John Wick uncredited, but it
sounds like a title, John Wick uncredited.
Yeah. It's wild. Like this is one where I feel like I just don't know if I saw the same movie as everyone else because I see people giving it pretty, pretty solid reviews online. And I feel like I watched a completely fucking different movie because I not even was really disappointed. I just did not enjoy basically anything from this and any of this movie. Like the jokes don't land. I think the action seems like it was more fun to shoot than it is to watch. Summing up the movie, for me, it just feels like, you know, David Leitch, who used to be a stuntman and is now a director, you know, he's talked about how this movie is an ode to stunt men and women and just stunt performers in general. And that really kind of shows in the movie, but I'm viewing that sort of in a negative way in the sense where it feels like a string of practical stunts or old school movie stunts that are just strung together with a, you know, haphazard, nonsensical, kind of boring story and plot with two leads that are both likable individually, but in their relationship in the movie, I feel like you're not giving me enough there for me to really buy into that love story and it being like a romantic action comedy. And it really just feels like a guy who got a bunch of his friends together who are stunt people and went, look, I can get us all paid to do some really cool old school stunts and big explosions and practical like leaps off things and car crashes and shit like that. And that's it. And I feel like you probably had a blast making the movie. I have no doubt people being goofy and doing crazy stunts and stuff like that. But when I watch it on screen, like none of it felt that exciting or impressive. And I'm sure in person it looked fucking impressive, all of it. But when I'm watching it on screen and when we've seen so many action movies and practical stunts and things like that, that it all just kind of fell flat to me. And I think when at its core, when you need to have this, you know, chemistry between these two leads and this love story, when you drop us into it and then show us like these very brief flashes and you just go, trust us, they were in love, and like, or they really, or like didn't realize they were in love or whatever, but like you don't get much of that relationship. And then you have this weird story that takes way too long to kind of play its cards, but is also very predictable, which is why you're just like, all right, the movie's called The Fall Guy. I get what's happening here. Let's fucking speed this up a little bit and give me more. Where I feel like it takes way too long to get going. And then once it gets going, it's predictable and kind of lame. I just was really disappointed in it and did not like much of this movie at all. So, I mean, that's me ranting off the top. But I'm surprised.
I'm surprised and disappointed.
Yeah. Anyways, what about you, man?
Well, you know what? Since the trailers came out, and you never judge a movie by the trailer, but the trailer felt so bloated and overlong, and like it was telling you everything that was going to be in the movie. And the film, you know, is over 2 hours, but it feels like it's six mm-hmm. when you're watching it. It's so sluggish, and it gets bogged down in extended sequences, not only of stunts, but of the meta humor and the sort of technical prowess. Oh my God,
none of that shit worked,
and so you don't buy into the romance or the chemistry, because Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling, as you said, are charming individually. They're likable on screen together, you know, just as actors,
yeah.
But they don't have any romantic chemistry. So when you have this split screen sequence, which weirdly takes place after the two were talking to each other in the hotel, but it almost feels like on Emily Blunt's side the next day or something yeah. like that, you're not buying in to the romantic interplay and interlude of it. So then you're focusing on, okay, well, what's this setting up for the next stunt? And then this is also, you know, Gosling's character coming down off of a drug trip, which is the most kind of obnoxious part of Drew Pierce's,
way overdone, man.
Drew
Stop.
Pierce's script, and that does fit into David Leitch's filmography of playing up sort of like, you look at Bullet Train, which is, you know, 10. And then Deadpool 2 is 11. This would be like 7 or 8 because of just that scene alone.
Yeah.
And even the sequence before where you have the red herring kind of character that Gosling goes to, you know, interrogate in the club, but turns into a kind of, you know, action sequence. But it feels, again, like a 13-year-old boy directed the scene. And talking about Drew Pierce, like Drew Pierce was a writer on Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. So there's no excuse, because, you know, we just talked recently about Challengers and how that made us feel in terms of the exhilaration of
yeah.
the film. That's what this should be doing. And instead, for every moment that there's a possibility of something interesting happening or a technical feat being executed in a different way, or a way that kind of gets you viscerally involved, it backs off. And I look at the first scene of the movie where Ryan Gosling's character breaks his back. The setup of that is actually really well yeah. done, where it's a one take
like
of him yeah. being very kind of casual, you know, going to work, getting ready, and, you know, putting himself on the ledge before falling back. That creates a sense of vertigo, and you're like, oh, I can't wait for him to utilize the IMAX cameras or to follow through as he's falling down. And it just cuts. And that's what the whole movie is.
The editing is awful, dude. The intercutting is so bad and rips you out of every sequence.
Yeah. And then with the relationship, the problem is that it's not a two-hander. So you're not getting a lot of you're getting none of Emily Blunt's side, because it is from Ryan Gosling's Colt Seaver's perspective. So when you're watching this character, he's setting things up in the voiceover narration and telling you what's going on. And so when he has his injury and then he's in the recovery mode, and you see that, you don't see, but you know, Gosling's character basically tells the audience that he just kind of took his time to recover and just never got in touch with anybody, including Emily Blunt. And so with her, when she's upset with him for, you know, ghosting her, I guess, you you don't feel completely bad for her, because it's like, well, the guy broke his back and nobody, at least from the, because it is his perspective, like, you didn't come to see him either. You know, it, you were doing your own thing. So, I mean, there, it takes two to tango, right? When it comes to relationship stuff. So you're not as sympathetic towards Emily Blunt's character, especially when, you know, she's torturing him on set, because, you know, realistically, and obviously this is a movie, so, but it's still,
oh, they let you know that it's a movie multiple times,
but it's a movie that still takes place within our reality, because they're referencing sure. Last of the Mohicans and the Bourne movies. Fast, but then also Furious. It's doing the Entourage kind of thing, where Tom Ryder, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, it that doesn't mesh, because though the movie that they're making, The Metal Storm, which is also very, that's the only funny thing I laughed at, because there's a movie from 1983 called Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin, which is in 3D, directed by Charles Band. That's funny to me because I know that, but nobody else does. So
I was going to say, is that the joke? Like, are they remaking that?
No, they're not. Because what they're parodying is Dune.
And Mad Max and the Rebel Moon. Yeah, well, the score for sure. But I'm just saying it's a mishmash of those kind of movies, right? Like, but I'm going to cut you off for a second here too. Even that parody stuff, like,
it's awful.
It doesn't work, man. Like I said I tweeted that I yearned for Tropic Thunder while watching this, and I know that they're very different movies, but movies about making movies and actors and you know, satirical and you know, even that last sequence with Jason Momoa in replacing Aaron Taylor Johnson in Metal Storm reminded me of the fake trailers you get at the beginning of Tropic Thunder and many other movies and things like that. But none of that shit works, man. Like, you have this movie being distributed by Universal, right?
Yep.
And then, like, why? Like, you could have so easily used an IP you had to even bring.
They do, though, too. More. At the beginning of the film, they show scenes from Atomic Blonde and Fast and the Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah, of course.
So why not? And why not make the lead actor not Tom Ryder, but do a parody of Taylor Johnson.
Yeah, like, actually have them play themselves, base it on a Universal property like a Jurassic Park or a Fast and Furious or something like that, and have them making that one of those movies that have a lot of stunts and shit in them. And I know that's kind of nitpicky, and
well, it's
and
also
crazy.
You don't want to poke fun.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. And I don't want to play backseat, you know, a screenwriter or something like that. But it just, that was one, another thing that just cheapened the whole thing for me. And like, so anyways, I wanted to jump in there, but keep going.
Yeah. Well, here's the other thing. And I will play backseat screenwriter a little bit.
Why
here,
not? Who cares?
Is that the twist in this movie that, you know, the producer played by Hannah Waddington, and
she's
Aaron
awful
Taylor
in
Jones.
This, and that character's awful.
Well, and I think the wig also hurts quite a bit, because it makes it worse. Yeah. And it's not
funny. Like a cartoon villain. It's just really bad.
And sometimes that works for this type of movie, but here it doesn't. And so with this storyline that you have these two characters in cahoots creating a criminal conspiracy, it just bogs the plot down in even more convoluted plotting. So once you get to, you know, the story of Gosling becoming this bounty hunter type character, tracking him down, you don't care. But then on top of that, it's like, okay, well, then he's framed for a crime he doesn't commit. They're talking about AI and deep fakes. And, you know, we just saw Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, which does all of this better and actually funnier, weirdly enough. And so you're watching this and you're thinking to yourself, okay, what this movie should have been is, it should have been a simple love story between two people that had a falling out. Treat it like a rom-com in that way. You know, he's brought onto set in Sydney, Australia, and in and around Australia. And you have a guy who's trying to get back into the saddle and is afraid that his own anxiety is going to tank someone he cares about, you know, their aspiring career, because this is, you know, Emily Blunt's character's Jodie, her first feature film as a director. And
just, she was a cinematographer before, a camera operator.
Assistant camera operator. And so, you know, the thing that you could do that would make it more insular and keep it on the set is that he's getting in his own way, you know, his anxiety and stress mm-hmm. of, you know, coming back to doing this again, because there's a little bit of that to begin with. And you think, oh, maybe this
then
is
they
something
just throw it out. And he just wants to impress her. So, yeah, like even the setup of why he's doing this for the Hannah Waddingham character makes no fucking sense to me.
It doesn't.
Like for him
it doesn't.
To be like, yeah, OK, I'll go do that. And then keep doing this over and over again after he like. Even after the first instance where the, you know, katana woman attacks him, like the girlfriend and like
Teresa Palmer.
Yeah, it's just it doesn't make any fucking sense to me where she's like, I need you to do this. And then he's like, why would I do that? And she's like, it'll impress Jody.
We're not going to talk about Jody.
What? Just for him to do all of this shit, like the motivation there to impress her, like. To save her movie that way is kind of weird, and I don't buy it at all for him to go at this length and then becomes this bounty hunter because of all of this shit. It just I never bought it. Like, again, this is my problem. It's like I don't need you to spoon feed me exposition or reasons why these characters can do things or why they're in love and things like that. But I think you need to develop that. And I feel like the movie didn't develop any of it. Right. Like it just said, trust us. He's good at this shit or good.
Trust in the chemistry and the charm of Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt.
That part, but even as him as a bounty hunter, and I know he fucks up and he's not great at it and things like that, but even like, yes, he's a stunt man, but does that make you an actual good, like, fighter or like or any of this shit? Like I know you're good at choreography and fake fighting and
you
stuff
can take
like
a punch
that, but
I guess,
like
right?
Yeah, but when he goes all John Wick in the club when he's on drugs and shit like that and beating up these henchmen and everything he's doing throughout the movie, I just like I never bought any of it.
You need a line where it's like, I used to be, you know, an operative from this particular
or show me anything. Like I feel like I agree with you, that opening shot of him being the stunt man and going through and then hurting himself is a great opener, but you just didn't give me enough on either character or especially him and their relationship for me to buy into any of it. And then it kept ripping me out. And then the jokes are so,
oh, it's awful.
Like it's a few of them land, but that's few and far between, right? Like I did chuckle a couple times, but that's because they're trying to throw so much at you. And I think Ryan Gosling is really fun when he's being kind of silly, right? So I think
when he goes off and finds
even Margaritas, like, yeah, like
that's funny because it's funny, basically.
Yeah, and he's like, so when he does those little inflections or those little goofy moments where you can tell he's just fucking around, like that shit is funny. But the movie, I think, thinks it's way more clever than it is, right? With its meta humor and the way that it's structured and characters referencing the split frame and the different things that happen in movies and stunts and whatever, where it just kind of became
the third act
obnoxious.
Keeps coming up about
don't
have the third act.
Yeah.
But the other thing that weirdly bothered me, even though I love one thing about it, and you'll get it as soon as I tell you it, you'll be like, yeah, that's such an Eric thing. One, this is based on, you know, the Lee Majors series from the early
the TV
80s
show,
that nobody remembers. But you have a reference or sort of a backstory of Gosling's character being
the
a
Miami
stunt
Vice
person
thing.
On Miami Vice.
Does that timeline even work?
It does. That's the problem.
I was like, what?
Miami Vice started in the mid 80s and ended in 89. If we're looking at Gosling, his actual age, he would be six.
That's what I thought the exact same thing, dude. And I don't even know Miami Vice that well. And I knew you would love that. That jacket is dope. Don't get me wrong. Like, Eric's grabbing, I'm assuming, his complete series of Miami Vice on Blu-ray. And I knew you would love that. I love the jacket as well. But when he said that, I was like, that makes no sense.
No.
Because there's no way this character.
It would have been funnier if it was the Fall Guy. If he worked on the Fall Guy, you know, like if that was the show he worked on.
Yes. And like, so what? You're aging the character up 10 more years? So is he playing in his 50s instead of his
40s? And Gosling doesn't look like that. Gosling is a young-looking guy.
Or I thought the movie might have taken place earlier, but they all have iPhones and stuff, right?
Yeah, like, and it's contemporary.
Yeah, what I mean. Like, they talk about Fast and Furious and they show Atomic Blonde and all that shit. And so, like, it made no sense, the Miami. Or maybe that's just it's a bit, maybe.
Well, maybe, like, it's something that David Leitch, you know, heard through anecdotally, or maybe he worked on it or knows somebody that, and then maybe he was bringing that in.
Sure.
Because the Fall Guy is kind of like, okay, well, there's this actor who goes from stunt, you know, movie or TV show to movie to TV show in an episodic way, and kind of gets involved in helping other people and is the unsung hero of, you know, the show. And that's kind of what it is. It's very much of like the 70s and 80s sort of style of television, where you have a main character who's kind of wandering. You look at the Bill Bixby, Lou Ferrigno, Incredible Hulk, or the David Carradine Kung Fu series. Those were the types of shows where it's like you have the guy, you know, moving from one thing to another, and then, you know, bringing in new cast members for that episode, and, you know, getting involved in a mystery or something like that, and pulling off stunts in the process. And, you know, the Lee Major series, I've seen a few episodes, but I always got that confused with the $6 Million Man. And that was his other kind of big show. And that's also been attempted to be adapted multiple times. But
was his name Steve Austin in that show?
Yes. Wasn't it? Yeah. Oh,
fuck
and
yeah.
The, and the spinoff of being the Bionic Woman. So, So, you know, like the Miami Vice thing does not make any sense.
No, it took me out of it. And I don't even, like, it took me out of it. Right when he said it, I was like, that timeline doesn't add up at all.
No,
but it's just, that's a little thing,
but it builds, it adds to everything else. And, you know, you're wasting really likable actors like Winston Duke as a stunt coordinator,
Stephanie Shue.
And I'm sure with Stephanie Shue's casting, it was probably, you know, as Everything Everywhere All at Once was coming out. So it was just like of the time, but it's more distracting now because, you know, that, you know, this is an Oscar nominated actor, you know, who's done, who gave such an amazing multifaceted performance in that movie. And it's like, she's wasted as an assistant in one scene. Yeah. And even that sequence where, you know, they're paying homage to Against All Odds using the Phil Collins song. And, you know, that movie is very hokey, but it has a great sort of car chase sequence, and it doesn't live up. The Fall Guys version of this does not live up to that original film, which was the early 80s. So, like, everything about, I think the problem is that David Leitch is not a good director.
Yeah.
I think he's obviously a very talented stuntman, and his concepts
are
interesting. But in terms of his follow through, or his fall through, he doesn't deliver. And even in stuff in like Atomic Blonde, where it's like, I like the setup of this and I should be, you know, engaged by it, but you never are. And you just feel like there's something missing there in terms of igniting that excitement. And then when you hear someone like Steven Spielberg loves this movie, you're thinking to yourself, okay, this is going to be something that maybe is a surprise. Because again, you know, Bullet Train was not my cup of tea. The majority of his stuff, not great. And so you're also then comparing it to, as you mentioned before, the John Wicks, the Bournes, the Mission Impossible movies, all these films, even the action in Challengers is so engaging. And then you watch this and you're just like, you're let down by it. And you just kind of feel as though, you know, it doesn't know when to stop certain moments. Like, it's like, okay, this is where you need to cut, or this is where you need to end this. And this is where you need to start, or, you know, when you're watching an interview and somebody answers a question and there's an interesting conversation there, it's like, follow up on that. And you never do.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely agree. Again, it's one of those movies where I'm like, I don't see what I guess the majority of people are seeing, because I'm seeing it get pretty good reviews or pretty good reactions, even from people who aren't critics and stuff like that, like audiences. But my wife did not like this movie at all. Like,
my brother hated it.
Yeah, like it's interesting that every once in a while you get one of these where maybe. But the thing is, I didn't even have like any expectations for this. Really, like I didn't even. It was Nevis who really wanted to go see it, so it's her fault I had to see it. No, I'm kidding. But again, there was enough, like, I like Emily Blunt and I like Ryan Gosling a lot. So like I was here for it. It's just, watching it, and then seeing people's reactions, I was genuinely shocked because I had no idea. I saw the movie. I'm like, oh, everyone must not like this movie either. It must have been bad, right? And then I look online. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the minority. I'm like, and then you talking to you, and then I'm like, okay, I'm not out of pocket here. Like, I guess other people feel the same way. And again, like we say with anything, we're film critics, but everything's subjective. Like what you want to like, and I'm glad you liked it if you liked it. But and I hate when I don't like a movie. It sucks. Like, I hate, like, it's sometimes you need to get it off your chest because you're like, I don't see what everyone else is seeing, but I'd much prefer to really enjoy something. And I unfortunately did not enjoy this at all. I'm going to go as low. I sound super negative, but I was originally at a 2 and I bumped it down to a 1.5 just because, like, I found very little to enjoy about this movie. Very little. Like, I laughed a couple times, and the rest of it, I just wanted it to end, and it felt like it would never end. So
yeah,
I really didn't like it. So 1.5 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, you know what? This is not the second coming of Barbenheimer, where a lot of people, I think, were excited just even on those terms of right. bringing those two actors together. I will watch Ryan Gosling in anything, and I will continue to. And I don't think it's his fault. Like, I think it's just that the material he's given, it's very arch, and he's working within a frame that doesn't allow him a room, really, other than, you know, those odd lines to kind of play with and have fun with. But this is a movie that, you know, the film that I think ultimately you have to compare it to, if you've seen it, is Richard Rush's The Stuntman with Peter O'Toole and Steve Railsback. And that is the setup is actually not too dissimilar in terms of, like, kind of being outlandish. So it's about this fugitive who is a draft dodger played by Steve Railsback, who is on the run, and he kind of accidentally finds himself caught up in a movie shoot because he thinks that there's this woman drowning and he goes to save her. And then he realizes that, oh, it's actually a movie being shot, and the dive into the water to save her, played by Barbara Hershey, ultimately impresses the director of the film, played by Peter O'Toole. And Peter O'Toole doesn't have the stuntman for the film, so he decides to blackmail Steve Railsback's character by saying, hey, I'll turn you in or work on this production for me. And the production becomes increasingly more unhinged because Peter O'Toole realizes he can up the stakes because there's there's nothing that Railsback can say in terms of complaining. And that movie is sadistic but funny and meta and weird. And, you know, it's not available on, like, the Blu-ray's out of print from Severin, but it is available on various streaming sites, including Tubi. And you watch that movie and you're like, this is what you would hope The Fall Guy would be. Maybe not in the sadistic sense, but in terms of, you know, keeping it self-contained on set, because movie sets are about controlled chaos. And if you focus on a love story within the context of a set and, you know, getting in your own way of things, that's an actually more compelling narrative. But Pierce's script feels like, okay, well, we have to cater to sort of like this popcorn, you know, entertainment. So let's add all this espionage and double crossing. And, you know, we didn't talk even that much about Aaron Taylor Johnson, who's giving this weird, like, Matthew McConaughey inflection in his voice. And, you know, it kind of is funny for about 5 seconds, but then it gets really tedious after a while. So really excited for Kraven the Hunter, which is now opening during award season. so for me, it's like, there's a lot there to appreciate in terms of the setup, and it's well intentioned in terms of giving, you know, stunt people their due.
And the stunts, I'm sure, again, they weren't necessarily that exciting to watch, but I'm sure they were impressive, I guess, from a practical standpoint.
Yeah,
but...
and stunt people deserve an Oscar category.
I absolutely agree.
And this movie even mentions that, and I think that that's great. And, you know, the Ryan Gosling and jackets in films.
Oh, my God. He always knows what he's jackets, doing. Dude.
But also, what would have been funnier and meta, and again, nobody would have got this other than Canadians, but it would have been amazing if it was a Breaker High jacket. Because that would have also worked. Because the age
man on Breaker High,
the age thing would have worked. So you're
as a kid,
you're nitpicking this whole movie because if you're not into it, that's all you have.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it a 2.5 out of 5. I'm being a little bit generous, but the Metal Storm joke in terms of it working for me as, sure. Oh, this is referencing this 83 movie, which it probably is not, is funny. So for that, it's a plain movie. Like, you throw it on.
Oh, totally. Which most of David Leitch's stuff are plain movies, right? Or train movies. One thing about Metal Storm, another thing that took me out of it, they're not shooting that movie on fucking film. No. What are we doing here? Like, they got film canisters on the camera. Not a chance in goddamn hell. No. Whatever time this movie is being shot, I'm like, I wasn't going crazy, right? They had film, like Panavision, like film, right?
Well, even shooting. Someone's wearing a Panavision. I think, no, it was Emily.
Oh, a
Emily
bunch Blunt of people had Panavision stuff. In the shirts. Which Panavision can be, I think, lenses as well and stuff like that. So that doesn't necessarily mean, but they had the film canisters, I believe, like on the cameras, showing that they were shooting Metal Storm on film. And I'm like, give me a fucking break. Not a chance.
Man, Australia right now is so hot in terms of productions. You have The Fall Guy. You have Anyone But You. You have Ricky Stenicki.
I mean, I get why you go to Australia. Beautiful country. You go everything shoot there. Everything can kill you. But,
which also would have been a funny joke that never comes up, is that there's no like wildlife incorporated, even though that might have been like childish. But like the idea that that could be a stunt in itself. Like, everything is poisonous.
Yeah. Anyways, that was another thing that I wanted to, they shot this on 35.
Really? It looks digital.
Oh my God. Okay.
Oh, that's even worse. So,
unless I'm wrong. Like, I like going on IMDb, because IMDb, again, it's like Wikipedia, where people can just put in whatever information. A lot of the time the studios or production people, whoever worked on the movie, will fill in these details. So I could be wrong. Take this with a grain of salt. But I went to go check. They shot some stuff with Panda, because they did use some of the footage they were shooting for Metal Storm as footage in the movie, right? So you see the Panavision Panaflex lightweight in some scenes, and different Panavision lenses and stuff like that, and cameras. But then it says, no, okay, wait. Cinema negative format 35mm. So I think they shot some of it on 35, because it says it was shot on Arri, which is a 4.6K digital format. And then Panavision, they must have shot that stuff that you saw them shooting in the movie on Panavision on film. So the Metal Storm stuff was being shot on film, and then that stuff, I guess that's how they got away with shooting at least a little bit of it on film, is like, well, we'll have them shoot the movie within the movie on film, that way we can have a little bit of that, but we don't have to shoot the whole movie and spend all that money on film and stuff like that. But so, hey, I guess they committed to that bit. But to me as a viewer, I'm like, no fucking way the studio's letting them shoot this movie on film, or her first movie. I guess maybe you negotiate that shit. I'm going way too deep into the weeds and none of this matters. But like, some of this.
But
is
it
like
takes
the
you
little
out of it, because it is playing with the
and
meta
no one
narrative.
Cares about that. No one cares about that except for like me and probably a couple other people. But it does take me out of the meta narrative, in the sense of going, you know, there is a world where, you know, first time filmmaker says, hey, I want to shoot my gigantic blockbuster on film.
But it's the wrong period, because like if this was to take place like actually in the 80s or 90s early 2000s.
But you're doing a highly CG kind of like.
Because I was talking to Kyle, because Kyle never Rebel had seen Moon. Freddy Got Fingered, and he watched that recently on Criterion. And that was shot on film. And it's like, okay, well, if that was
watching
now,
Freddy Got Fingered on Criterion is a hilarious sentence.
Yeah. But also it being shot on film. It's like, there was a time where everything shot on film. So why not set it in the 80s and 90s?
Sure.
So it takes that.
I agree with
disbelief.
That. Actually, I would have preferred if the movie was a period piece, right? Yeah. Like setting it even in the 80s or whenever.
Because then the Miami Vice thing also makes more sense, because it's like, okay, well, you can buy into his age.
And that's what I thought, but I'm pretty sure everyone has iPhones, right?
Yeah, like, it's modern.
So I was confused, because I'm like, oh, maybe this is set in the 2000s or something like that, or something, when like film was just getting, you know, phased out. Because I even watched Iron Man the other night, and I put Incredible Hulk on, terrible movie, but it's shot on film, right? Like the first three or four
first
MCU
two Iron
movies,
Man movies and Incredible Hulk.
an Incredible Hulk, and I think Captain America, or was Captain America the first digital one?
Captain America looks really digital to me.
I think it might be digital. So I think only like the first three, Thor, I think the first Thor was shot on film. So it's
no wonder his eyebrows are blonde in that one.
The first two Iron Men, the Incredible Hulk and Thor, I think were the only four shot on film, and then they switched everything to digital with Captain America leading into the Avengers. But just watching Iron Man, I was like, fuck, man, like I'm nostalgic. Even it's nostalgic for, because the only movies that get shot on film now are kind of like, you know, from auteurs that can, you know, or, you know, Nolan are big blockbusters and stuff like that. But just watching something as crappy as The Incredible Hulk and it was shot on film, I'm like, this movie is bad, but it looks nice.
Hey,
like,
Zanzibar has like, never looked better.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, but it looks nice. So it's just one of those things that not everything looks exactly the same. And I'm not saying all digital cinematography looks the same, because you get a good cinematographer and a good colorist and people like that, and you can make a digital film look good. I just think people get lazy and, you know, everything tends to start to look the same, right? When you're going, you're having studios go, you have to shoot with this camera, it has to be in this format, and then everything looks the same, right? And I get it from a Netflix standpoint, or whoever is, because I'm learning all this stuff in school now too, right? Where like Netflix, when you're shooting something for them, they have approved cameras you can use, right? Like it's not, unless you're someone like
Alfonso Cuarón.
Cuarón or something like that, that goes, no, I'm shooting, you know, a Guillermo or something like that. Like someone who's working with them that's a big auteur that can kind of work in their contract. But for the most part, and I'm sure the MCU
not the
has
Russo
this,
brothers, speaking of Ryan Gosling being bad action movies.
Yeah. So we're kind of going on a tangent here, which we usually do at the end of our reviews, but
not about cereal this time.
No, I think people like the cereal chat.
I did too.
But for me, it's film formats are so when I see that in a movie, to bring it back full circle, and I see them shooting on film, it's not that it couldn't happen, because it could. But I just, my brain goes, would they be shooting that? There's no way they'd be shooting this movie unless those action sequences they're shooting on film. I don't know, who the fuck cares. But anyways, my point being, I agree with you. Make it a period setting, even if that period is the 2000s, because that's nostalgic now.
New metal soundtrack.
Yeah, like all that shit could have worked, right? And like seeing something like Iron Man or Incredible Hulk, and you know, even weird zany comedy movies or shitty action movies, they were all shot on film at one point because it was the only way you could do it. So anyways, I'm going off, but
it gives those bad movies more character than they maybe they deserve in terms of like the texture and look of them.
Exactly. And like, it's, you know, there are movies shot on film that can look bad, don't get me wrong, but
film can be unforgiving, especially if you don't know how to light it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's not that all, you know, things shot on film look better than everything shot on digital. That's not what I'm saying either, but
it's how you use it. Because if they did shoot on film for this, it doesn't look like it. It looks like shitty, like,
I think digital. It was just those sequences for Metal Storm that they shot on,
which
film.
It still doesn't look like film.
No, I know. You might as well have just shot it digitally, right? On IMAX cameras or something like that. That would have made more sense to me if you were shooting on like the more modern digital, like IMAX cameras. I am excited about, you know, we're just going off on film formats and stuff now. Anyways, I hope you guys enjoyed the review on The Fall Guy. I want to keep talking about movie cameras. There was a trade show recently. What was it called? It's just about like cameras and technology, like cinema technology and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Your joke that nobody else ripped off.
Oh, yeah. I know, right? So the IMAX, the new IMAX camera, the film camera that they announced, right? Like, I love that they're still investing in that and they're improving the IMAX film camera to make it lighter and quieter and blend that analog and digital format, right? Like, because it seems very modern in the way that you can hook it up to, you know, very digital things, but you're still shooting on a very analog format. And I know the later film cameras all did that stuff too, but it makes me excited that, you know, and there was someone at the Oscars, who was it? Was it that talked about shooting on film was easier than you think or whatever like that? Or
was it Hoyt Van Hoytema?
Yeah, it might've been Hoyt Van Hoytema.
Because he's been using IMAX a lot with Oppenheimer and Nope. Yeah.
And film in general, right? He's saying like, it's not as expensive as you think, like try to convince them to let you do it. So I wonder if we'll see like a resurgence in it. And I know this has nothing to do with the Fall Guy other than it annoyed me that they used a film camera, but I hope it becomes this weird, like, nostalgic thing where more filmmakers, younger ones and stuff like that, go, you know what? Like, I miss how that looks. I'm going to try to shoot my movie on that.
Well, just even something that is not an auteur driven film, like just something that's maybe like middle of the road studio fare that gets, you know, a theatrical release that doesn't need to be shot on film, but just is shot on film.
Yeah, just to see, right? Like, and you're only going to get certain cinematographers. Because again, no one's being taught it anymore either, right?
Which is unfortunate, because I think it is still a tool. It's just, you know, obviously cost and accessibility do play a factor in these things. And that's why I think like IMAX is adapting itself, because they realize, okay, well, we need to have, you know, this other way of thinking, not just, you know, focus on film. Like, film is our meat and potatoes, but at least we have this as well. And I think that's the same thing with film versus digital. I think you should know the two disciplines and be able to work within them and should have access to them. It's just so unfortunate that we've gotten to this point where a lot of filmmakers don't use it anymore. And people people like David Fincher or Michael Mann, like, obviously, you know, they can do a gazillion takes and not have to worry about cost.
Right? Yeah.
But their movies shot on film are so beautiful looking.
In Fincher's defense, his digital stuff does look great too.
It does.
But like,
it does.
And that's the point that I was going to say is, you know, you're unfortunately you're, you know, whatever the studio or whoever you're working for, production company, they just want things quicker and cheaper, right? And film is going to be slower and more expensive every single time, right? Because of how much you have to be careful, how much you shoot, how long it takes to switch out the film reels, developing.
I mean, you're learning about you know, color timing and you know, post-production, and you know, you've told me a little bit about how like time consuming that is, and just to focus on like one aspect of it. And it's not just, you know, it's not just picture, but it's also, you know, sound. And so you take, you know, something from one stage to the next, and studios, especially with tentpole films or blockbusters, they set up a deadline or a release date before the movie is even, you know, put into production.
And you got to think special effects too, right? Way harder, I'm assuming, to do on film. We're going to see Phantom Menace tonight.
First shot on film.
Attack of the Clones was the first one.
This was shot on film. This was like the last Star Wars movie to be shot on film.
So there you go. We brought it full circle. We'll talk a little bit about that probably next time we do a full episode or something like that, because I'm excited to check out Phantom Menace for not the first time on the big screen since seeing it, because we did do that big Star Wars marathon before Force Awakens, but I barely remember seeing that. That was such a blur that day. So I'm excited to see that tonight. Anyways, The Fall Guy, not very good, but I hope you enjoyed it. I don't know. As always, you guys can check out more of our work around the internet, mostly at untitledmoviepodcast.com. And you can follow us on Letterboxd and other places, but please go to our Letterboxd, Untitled_movies. All of our reviews and things are over there. And you can follow me on all those social medias at Matt Rohrbeck.
Yeah, and you can follow me on the social medias at EM6211 and find more video reviews on RogersTV.com/CinemaScene. And there's a couple interviews up now that you can check out as well. I have an interview with Caitlin Cronenberg for Humane. I also have interviews coming up for Gasoline Rainbow with the Ross Brothers, which I'm really excited to share because I really love those guys. Interviews with writer-director Radu Jude and Alinka Monolake for Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World.
Awesome. Until next time.
I'm not ready to fall for the Fall Guy.
God damn it.